This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Rockstar Energy Drink. Be honest, are you procrastinating by listening to this podcast? It's okay. You just need Rockstar Focus. Choose from three delicious flavors, each crafted with ingredients for an ideal energy and mental boost, like Lion's Mane, 200 milligrams of caffeine, and zero sugar. Visit rockstarenergy.com to learn more. At least 75 milligrams of caffeine has been shown to help improve attention.
Sweet Tarts dared to combine sweet and tart, but we didn't stop there. We combined soft and bouncy to bring you new Sweet Tarts Gummies Fruity Splits, a uniquely delicious dual-sided gummy with one side that's sweet and one side that's tart, but entirely smooth and squishy. Mmm, a powerfully perfect combo. Sweet Tarts, dare to combine.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Myrtle Beach. You know what's better than getting away to a beach? Getting together at the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. They've got over 2,000 restaurants, live music playing all day and night, and endless attractions. This place was made for playing hard and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 Miles Where You Belong. The beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Hello, I'm Kellyanne Taylor, and this is the Radio Times podcast. Every week, I sit down with a celebrity guest from the world of TV or film to talk about their lives, both on and off screen. To my fellow TV enthusiasts, I hope you enjoy listening. This week, I have an absolute treat for you. This interview is one of my favourites to record, so I really hope you enjoy it. Joining me in the studio is the British actress, presenter and author Joanna Lumley. Born in India in Kashmir, Srinagar, she was brought up in the Far East, coming to the UK aged 8 to attend boarding school. She went on to work as a model and actress, living in London in the swinging 60s and made her name starring as Purdy in The New Avengers. She boasts a successful career spanning over 6 decades. She had audiences in Hysterics as Patsy in hit sitcom Absolutely Fabulous, has presented wonderful travel programmes, and of course captured the nation in Jan Etherington's radio show, Conversations from a Long Marriage, in which she stars alongside Roger Allam. In this episode, we talk about why she doesn't have a mobile phone, how difficult she found it to shed the pretty girl stereotype when she moved from modelling to acting, and why she wishes sex scenes would be cut from TV and film. Joanna Lumley, welcome to the Radio Times podcast. I'm so happy to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have just told you how beautiful you are, but I think this is going to be such a treat for our listeners because your voice is like honey.
Oh, stop. I tell you whose voice is like honey and who most of the people who approach me say, look, you sound all right, but Roger Allam is the one we love.
Oh, he does have
and
a nice
so this
voice.
This was just extraordinary. So I've been thrilled to be paired with him. But anyway, I also do a lot of voiceovery things. And I think you have to become more conscious of your own voice. Mm. But when it's fitted onto something else, you've got to fit in with things. And so you are aware of it, because usually we all speak. When we speak, we don't listen to ourselves. Mm-mm. You've no idea what you sound like.
No.
So it's always been a shock when people have said kind things. So I've thought, hurrah. So thank you.
You're so very welcome. Okay, this conversation goes a bit everywhere. We're going to talk about your TV viewing habits, a bit about your career, and of course, Conversations from a Long Marriage. Mm. Let's start with, what is the view from your sofa? Talk me through your living room setup.
A fireplace. So sofa sitting facing a fireplace, open fire.
Oh.
Yeah. Our house is very tall. It's about 5 stories tall. And I thought if anybody is going to actually stand outside to see if smoke's coming out of the chimney, we deserve to be arrested. I love open fires. We don't have them very often. Lots and lots of bookshelves on each side of the fire, bookshelves behind us. And paintings more than literally frame to frame up to the ceiling. I've got a passion for paintings. more bits and pieces. I'm a maximalist rather than minimalist.
Very nice.
And my husband's very patient. And we have sort of stuff, kind of a lot of stuff. So if you can find your way into the room, you can sit down comfortably. And there is a television set, and rather in a rather bourgeois manner, I keep it covered up because I don't like flat black screens because I think that it's rather odd. And I haven't yet got to the stage where people quite cleverly have their television screen, which turns into a picture until you switch it on.
Yes.
Have you seen that?
I have seen that.
It's kind of a picture.
It's very trendy.
So anyway, I have mine behind a cupboard door so I don't have to see it.
And when you do watch TV, what have you enjoyed watching most recently?
Oh, literally everything. I adore travelling things. And so I do travel programmes and I watch Simon Reeves. So I think he's just great. I love what I call a sort of special pain television, which is watching things like The Apprentice and First Date, anything that makes you absolutely curl with embarrassment and horror. I love those.
Is that, would you say, a guilty pleasure or no?
No, it's not guilty at all. I'm quite brazen about it. I simply adore it. That's why they make them, is for people to go, oh my heavens, how can this person who's boasted about something get it so badly wrong on television? I think they're sort of agonising. But actually, we've bought a box set. This sounds quite strange, but it's our viewing habits. We've bought a box set of all Shakespeare's plays, which are done by the BBC.
Oh, wow.
Back starting in the 70s and 80s. And they're sensational because I realise I know a lot of Shakespeare plays and not all of them. And a lot of them you think you know and you see them again. And when they've got directors like Jonathan Miller and all the actors you can possibly imagine, from John Gielgud to everybody you can possibly love, they're magic.
Do you have a favourite?
I pretty much like Twelfth Night, yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Why?
That's not my favourite.
What's your favourite?
I watched an adaptation of Coriolanus with Ralph Fiennes in. That's my favourite film adaptation.
I think my favourite was Romeo and Juliet with DiCaprio.
With Basil. I love that. That's one of my all-time favourites.
Very, very good. Should show that in schools for children who think
Absolutely.
They don't like Shakespeare.
It's so beautiful. And that fish tank scene, it's just iconic. Mm. And I also love Julius Caesar. That's my hand on heart favourite.
That was my O-level English, I think.
What a
Julius
treat.
Caesar, yeah. And at the time, the film out was Brutus, played by James Mason, Marlon Brando as Mark Antony.
Oh, my
Extraordinary,
goodness.
Yeah.
Wow, well, that's an exceptional part. Who controls the remote in your household? Is it you or your husband?
We don't sort of live like that.
No?
No. Sometimes he's in a different room watching cricket. So we don't have to do that, you know what I mean?
Not a cricket fan?
I like cricket. But all day cricket. I sometimes go in and see how well it's going. You get fond of what your partner likes, and so I've become fonder of, car racing, because he likes that, and so I know all the cars and things like this. But we don't really. We watch television, but we read a lot and we listen. He's a musician, so we don't. You know, we're not ruled by the box.
Yes. What about radio? What's your favourite radio show?
I don't know if I've actually got a favourite show. I don't really know if I have one. I like to listen to Desert Island Discs, only because I pray they'll get some fabulous music on. Quite often they have quite a lot of modern music, you know, recent pop tunes and things, which I don't know. Well done them. I like Michael Barclay's show at 12 o'clock called Private Passions. That's my favourite one.
That's very nice. And is there a station that you like?
Yeah, a Radio 3, Radio 4. I like to chop and change if I can, remember what time things are on and catch them.
Do you just have it on in the background a lot?
No, I don't like things in the background. I listen to them or turn them off. I don't like background music. Either I listen to the music or not have it on.
Ooh. Okay, I like that. And also it means you're present or you're engaging with it properly rather than, I think we live in a world of phones
Well, I think
now.
It's very different now because I know a lot of children do their homework and prep and essays, I guess, with music on in the background. I can't think how you where your mind would be with music.
Either
it's good music or it's wallpaper music, which is banned in our house. Banned. It's so ghastly. It comes on every show. If you watch anything, they've got this sort of
background
library music.
Yes.
Jin. It's just a nightmare.
Okay, let's take it back to childhood. So you were born in India, in Kashmir, Srinagar, but you were brought up in the Far East and then you came back to England aged 8. What was your childhood like?
An army child. So my sister and I went wherever my parents went, because my father served with the Gurkhas. And so when we left India, we went out to Hong Kong. When we left Hong Kong, we went to what is now Malaysia.
Wow.
But it was completely normal. Children think things are normal.
Mm.
They, whatever happens to a child, they think it's normal. Mm. So although we did enormous journeys to and fro, I did five times across the world in troop ships, taking a month or 5 weeks each time. Wow. And that's because nobody flew in those days, because army children didn't fly. So it was a different way of being, you know. It's so long ago that it's become history and people can't imagine it. Nobody had telephones or made telephone calls. You wrote letters. You waited for a letter and you wrote a letter back again. I dreaded telephones and I still don't use a telephone now. I won't use a mobile phone.
Really?
No, I won't receive calls. Won't have it. Waste of life. Waste of time.
How do people communicate with you? Do you have a landline? Email?
There's a landline at home. Mm. I pick it up. I say, hello. No, I mean, what I mean is I can't stand being on call.
Yes.
I can't see the point in it. How do you live your life if you're always reacting? And how can you have your own fresh ideas and thoughts if you're always responding to something?
And that feels to, you know, I grew up in, I think I probably had my first phone at about 10. And that was only because I was doing kind of extra work on TV and my parents would let me have it so I could message in the break, just let them know how I was doing. But I feel like I was probably the last age that grew up or had part of my childhood or teenage years without a phone.
Mm.
And that now to a younger audience would be,
I know,
far away. And I don't think for the best. I think there is a real beauty in being present, being able to communicate.
I can't see the point in them. I know people say you've got to keep checking up. You haven't. Nobody checked up. You don't have to, you don't have to have them. If you're without them, people they're addicted. That's the sad thing, is we've fed this addiction in. And people seem to think that now it's very important to know what your child's doing all the time. I think I'd have had a fit if, having left home, my parents, who I could not have loved more, I adored them so much, were always checking up on me, always ringing up, always finding out where I was, always knowing who I was with. I can't think of anything more crippling, more debilitating to a young mind than being checked up on all the time.
Do you think that moving around a lot and having that slightly nomadic lifestyle early on prepared you for acting? Because it's not a job where there is security. No matter how successful you are, there is an element where you're moving a lot. And I guess I'm also asking, where do you feel is home?
Well, when we were children, home was wherever there was a little Chinese rug my mother had for us children, and a picture of a squirrel, and a picture, I think, of Mrs. Tiggy Winkle. And as little children, wherever those things were, that was home. So it didn't matter. So I'm at home. I like to feel I'm at home anywhere.
Mm.
Settle in. And when you're traveling, the SAS always say, make yourself, even if you've only got a pile of stones or something, make it a special space and be there. Make yourself comfortable on a tree trunk or something. Make yourself at home. So I've never thought, and also as a child, because my parents never had a home, they were both brought up in India and we were all peripatetic. I've never felt a kind of yearning No, that's wrong. You have home, but I don't think of somewhere as home, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
I don't know if it's important.
Mm.
And I don't think travelling makes you an actor. I think an awful lot of our best actors didn't travel at all. I think it's just something you do. I mean, I was a show-off, and so that's you know, just entertain. I'm an entertainer, really. I think people just long to entertain. You want to make people laugh, or you want to tell stories. I think if I hadn't been an actor, I would have liked to have been a teacher, because I love literature. And it's hard. You look back over your life, you just are, things just are. I've never had a plan. I've never had an ambition. I just drift along, and if stuff happens, you kind of do it, you know?
So do you think it was early days that you thought, maybe acting for me? Because it's not a career that seems, there's no easy path. You know, it's not like to become a lawyer. You go and you do these steps and then you apply and you
do hard steps.
Yes.
And then you're still not guaranteed.
That's it.
I mean, you're guaranteed if you're a plumber or an electrician.
That's true.
Those are sensible things to do.
And always needed.
Always needed. Beef, booze and boxes. That's the other thing. So either become a victualler or build coffins and sell drink. I don't know. But as an actor, it's the only gambling. I don't like gambling, but I love gambling with my life. I love not knowing what happens. I can't stand knowing what I'm going to do next year. I couldn't bear it.
Which is, well, it's strange.
I think a lot of people
me,
are like
yes.
that. No, well, I think a lot of people are like that. I never owned a house until I was 40, rented. And this passion for owning, I can understand it.
Do you think it's a new thing?
No, it's not. It's because it's the only way you can make money is because all property is pushed up all the time. So everybody's frantic to have something which makes money.
Yeah.
But when I came up to London in the swinging 60s, money was considered very vulgar. You never talked about money. And if anybody had money, quietly they'd pay for things. If you didn't have money, you'd hold your head high and be at least entertaining and look nice. So this obsession with having money and things like rich lists and showing how much you've spent for things by having Chanel written on your clothes or something, it was so alien to those 60s days. So I've still got 60s dreams in my head, really.
And tell me a bit about that time.
Well, it's made to sound much more glamorous than it was, and
it
also much more widespread
glamorous.
Than it was, because it was mostly London and a few cities, Manchester, Liverpool and things, but it didn't really spread across the country. I was a model, so I was then in the thick of it, because there was fashion, pop music, rock bands and things like that. Also, hairdressers and photographers were hugely important, artists and a kind of wild, hippie-ish dream of a better world where things were shared. That was, we all left our doors open, you know?
Yeah.
We had, if you had something, you shared it. And that seems, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to have melted away a bit. We're very security conscious, hence the telephones always checking out where people are and whether we've got insurance for things. You wouldn't have dreamed of having insurance.
That's so true. Well, also, you had a baby very young. Mm-hmm. So did you feel the pressures to be financially secure in that sense, or did that not matter because there was that community around?
No. Well, I mean, when you've got your own child, you should look after it. And so I knew that, and I then all the money I got was to make our flat safe, and I mean, you know, with enough food for Jamie, and I had to go on working, so I had an au pair girl who was really like a sister, because I was only 21, 22, 23, so it's quite young. So an au pair girl of 18 or 19 would be like a younger sister. Mm-hmm. And they were just adorable, and we got by on not very much money. I did The New Avengers, which was a big television show, which made my name. That's an odd thing to say, but I was 30 when I did that.
Did that at the time feel quite old? I mean, I'm only 27, but I feel like 30, that's me starting out. Hopefully it's going up, but...
Not really. No, it wasn't old, but I mean, I'd been working as an actress from 21 to about 29. Done lots of things, done movies and plays and Coronation Street and Dracula and shows in the West End and things. But the New Avengers is the one which got my name remembered, and it had no money attached to it, but it had a name attached to it. And then after that, I sort of then worked pretty solidly from then on.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Myrtle Beach. You know what's better than getting away to a beach? Getting together at the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. They've got over 2,000 restaurants, live music playing all day and night, and endless attractions. This place was made for playing hard and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 Miles Where You Belong. The beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Let's talk about some of your big roles. So, there was Purdy, and that surprises me that there wasn't that financial element because it became so successful. But well, do you think
no,
that
they
was just
didn't
how it
pay
was?
Me or Gareth. No, we were just very, very, very underpaid because we were signed on for 5 years. The first 2 years were that, second year that, third and fourth years, I could have bought a small country. But only they knew they were going to stop after 2 years. So they knew they could get us at rock bottom.
Goodness. Okay, so then you come on to Captivate the Nation with your role as Patsy Stone and Absolutely Fabulous.
That was a great, long time later, but yes, that was wonderful.
I've seen the clips and I would love to go back and actually sink my teeth into the entire series because you're so different. Obviously, you're an actor and you're acting and it's a role, but there's a real humour and warmth. And also you're watching your character and you're thinking, she's a little bit unlikable at times. You know, there's things that she's saying that you're thinking,
they were ghastly. No, but Adina and Patsy were vile. I mean, that was the whole point of it. It was a satire, a very high satire on the fashion world, who took it extremely well and loved it. But they were just utterly repellent women. I mean, there's nothing to commend either of them. They were completely ghastly. So it's very funny. But they were funny. But the thing is, it was funny. And if things are funny, it works.
Mm.
And Jennifer's a very brilliant writer. And Ruby Wax used to chip in a bit. And she cast it very well with June Whitfield and Jane Horrocks, Julia Sawala as well. And so we were the five main kind of core bits. But everybody who came in, it was magic to work on. Really, really funny. Mm. We did it live in front of an audience every Friday night.
Wow.
Which is tough because it's a proper show. We tried to get it right all the time. Very occasionally, something went wrong. We laughed, but hardly ever. Because doing comedy is a very serious, sounds odd, serious business when you're doing it. When you're sorting it out, we cried with laughter in rehearsals. But when you're doing it in front of an audience, it's not up to the actors to laugh. It's up to the others to laugh.
And to hold divine. That while they are laughing.
Yeah, but comedy... If you're doing comedy, you know how to ride it and when to come in. But it's different acting in front of an audience, but on television. You're the servant of the screen rather than the audience. But your instinct is with the audience because to entertain an audience. So it's a different, it's a balancing act, you know.
Do you think things like that still exist today? And does it feel like a shame we don't do more in front of an audience?
Well, there's a tremendous energy that comes from having to work in front of an audience because you're so frantic to get it right. We had no rehearsal. Read through on Monday, kind of rehearsed on Tuesday, block it on Wednesday, do outside broadcast on Thursday and live in front of the people. For half an hour of comedy, and comedy's far the hardest thing to do.
Yes.
Drama and tragedy come low down on the list compared to the drama with comedy, because comedy, if they don't laugh, you're dead. Whereas in drama, it can be tense, it can be silence and nothing. In tragedy, you don't even expect people to cry. They can again be just silence. But comedy, if there are no laughs, it's not funny.
When your career choice is acting and you're also modelling, there is a pressure to look a certain way.
I was also writing. I stopped modelling when I was 21.
Wow. So
I stopped it and became
an
actress.
And how easy was it to transition from
very,
acting
very hard
to modelling?
In those days, because in those days, models were considered the lowest of the low. And so as an actress, you're supposed to have gone to drama school, supposed to have done your 42 weeks in rep or whatever. So it was a hard hill to climb. But I just took everything that was offered, scrabbled my way in. I've always thought of it, Kellyanne, as going round a house and seeing which windows are open, thinking I could get in there later and finding a window and gemming it open and getting in through the back door. So everything I've done has come through the back door because I didn't have any training. I would refuse to go to university, didn't want any of that.
Did you feel, because you'd come from modelling and it was difficult to get in, did you feel maybe that you were cast as perhaps, in inverted
commas,
of course,
no, you're always cast
one.
As pretty. Well, you are, you're cast as a pretty girl. Because if you're 22 or 3 and you're pretty, you're a pretty girl. You're not going to play a woman of 45 who has 3 children in Birmingham. I mean, that's just stupid. You're typecast from the second you're born, really. So you can change that kind of in that people, that's why people are so shocked by Patsy, because you go, oh, but she's not like that. They forget that acting is acting. It's pretending to be somebody else, pretending to be somebody else. But you're caught up in this. You're stuck in this.
It's
so unless
vessel.
You change it hugely, you're going to look like you do.
I went to an all-girls school and I felt... that was in my secondary school years until I was 16, and then I went to a mixed school. And when I was at the all-girls school, I felt very much the onus was on to do very well. There was a lot of competition academically, but because it was only girls, it was never really about aesthetics. It didn't really play into it. And then when I went into the real world at 16 and suddenly realized, oh, actually, if I make more effort, I perhaps have a better social standing, or learning all those things that hadn't really been available to me. And I'm asking that because you went to an all-girls school. If you realized perhaps that beauty did play a part in how you get ahead.
Not a school, no. School, we just looked like gorillas. We were hopeless. but modelling, then you go, oh, modelling, I see what they do. And then everybody had their, we all had eyelashes. You play the game. You just jump into it. Just do what's necessary. Mm-hmm. Do what's necessary at the time. If you're trekking across the Himalayas, you don't worry about your beauty. But if you're at modelling in a London photographic studio with David Bailey, you look beautiful. So I don't think you want to get too caught up with things, you know. Change, switch, and you can slip around. We're not compelled to be anything except civil and compassionate. Without those things, I find people very dreary. So people who are critical, very critical of other people, I find boring.
There was a survey done recently by Radio Times, and we did it. It was called the Screen Test Awards, and they were looking at television, and they said that TV is getting kinder. But I think what they're saying is things like reality TV are becoming kinder. We're less looking at screens and trying to tear someone apart, almost. And do you think that's a part of, do you think it's a society?
I don't really know enough about reality television shows, unless, of course, First Dates is one.
Yes. Which is a nice show, isn't it?
I think it's sweet when they do get lucky and like each other. That's sweet. But quite a lot of the time it's cruelty, actually. I'm ashamed of watching it. And when Stephen and I had watched the other night An Apprentice, he said, I don't think we can watch this anymore. Because either it's been edited to make these people look catastrophically useless and vain.
Or they've been cast.
Or they really are that, in which case it's cruelty on the part of the television to have picked out people who are such obvious losers. You know, and that's cruelty, that's mockery. So it's lazy. It's lazy of me to have said those are favourite programmes. They're not really favourite programmes. I like things that take you out. I like things that can take you away. So we watch a lot of old films. We watch a lot of movies. And of course, with BAFTA just brewing up, and I'm on, like a million other people are, on the judging thing of BAFTA, which means you watch lots and lots of films. Mm-hmm. So you get to watch lots of films. And more films in the foreign language. I like foreign things. Mm-hmm. When we were young, also, we watched a lot of French films. There were French cinemas in London, the Paris Pullman and Academy 1 and 2, which showed only foreign films. And we all saw foreign films all the time.
Yes.
We've become a little bit insular. And, of course, since leaving the European Union, we've become much worse. And we're so clouded with our centrality, isolated mentally as well.
And there's real beauty in French cinema. I remember growing up, I did French, and that was only because in A-levels. And that was only because I wanted to be French. I wanted that chicness. And I fell in love with the French cinema we were watching at school. And there is a real beauty in it that felt kind of other, but also perhaps still slightly accessible if I drank coffee and smoked cigarettes.
I know. And the French also made their films. We, in the English-speaking languages, you make films, American makes films for America and hope the rest of the world likes it. But Australians and British and the English-speaking nations make films for, they hope, the world, which is impossible. The French make films for France.
Yes.
They don't care if anybody watches them or not. They want France to see them.
Yes.
So they speak in French and do it the French way. And I find that absolutely irresistible.
Can we talk about changes in the industry? So since you started out, areas that you've noticed the most change in, areas that are still the same?
I think one area is behind the cameras. A lot of, in the olden days, women on a film floor would be continuity, who are now called script editors, and makeup artists maybe, and all the rest were men. All the rest were men. And now we have women editors, women cameramen, sound. I mean, some of the things on big film studios are literally men are stronger than women. Mm-hmm. And therefore, some of the things men do, some of the grips and things are better to be men because they're literally physically stronger. But I've seen a great broadening of how many jobs women have. Mm-hmm. I've seen a great broadening in the work for older women, because older men have always had work. Mm-hmm. Spencer Tracy and people never stop working. But older women, the cutoff was about 40. I did a film in 1969, I think, with Ava Gardner, who was then only early 40s, 42 or something. And she was making a film which was her comeback film because, she, you know, now she was old. I mean, she looked ravishing. She had a sort of 18-inch waist still. She looked sensational. But she was old and making a comeback. Now, that doesn't happen now. And
no.
Now you can see from the kind of, A, the marvellous actresses who are around in the world are still there and still being marvellous. So you'd be a fool to drop them and try always to find somebody new. But beauty will always have a place on screen, always. People will always look for somebody gorgeous like Margot Robbie.
Like you say, it's that making also for those women and to give them roles. It's also about portraying how women are in real life. It's, I think perhaps there was an era, and that's not for all roles, but felt we were excluded from our experiences of aging or seeing different types of women, not just mother,
yeah,
unfleshed, you know, just 2D mother, 2D girlfriend, mm-hmm, and actually letting great actresses sink their teeth into a 3D dimension or 3D mm-hmm reality of women's lived experiences.
I know, it's dragged its heels, this one, a long time, yeah, because men were allowed to be men with all the complexities, and women were always a pretty secretary or a panic-stricken mother or, a hard-hearted aunt or a cosy granny. I mean, they seem to be terribly limited areas to work in. But now they're beginning to make films about people, which is what we all want, really.
Yes. Another thing that's obviously changed massively since the Me Too movement, but actually, I'm going to preface that. I grew up in an era where nudity felt very normal on screen. Mm-hmm. And my parents, I think, were always slightly shocked at how normalised it was. And it's only as an adult that I'm starting to look at things and think, is that necessary? Or I don't like that in, for example, and I use this example a lot, in Game of Thrones, you've got a brothel scene and all of the men are fully clothed or with armour and all of the women are entirely naked. And it feels that the only necessity of that is to have breasts on screen, for example. What do you think? But also, how important do you think it is that we have things like intimacy coordinators?
I've always, and it's never left me, I'm bored stiff with sort of sexy love scenes on screen or on stage. They bore me rigid. So I kind of have to whistle or just wait till they're finished.
Mm. They're everywhere now.
But a lot of nudity, you see, as an actor, you've got the audience with you, believing in your character. The second you take your clothes off, people look at you, the actor, and what your attributes are, what your breasts are like, what your genitals are like. They look at you. So you've immediately lost the character you've spent so long building up because they're looking at you. So I can't see the point in it. Anyway, people love it. There's a great peep show element. There's a great playground element. Pull your pants down, you know, let's see what you've got kind of thing. And that still goes on. And intimacy things, I'm sure, I mean, you know, I'd cut all those scenes altogether. They slow things down. And they're rude. They're horrible. I don't watch people on the lavatory. I don't watch people in bed when they're making love. I don't have to see them. So I don't know why they're there. Unless something happens and during it, a dagger's stuck through the neck or somebody manages to see where the tattoo is on somebody's bottom. Unless there's an actual reason for it. If you're just watching bonking, I can't bear it.
And it feels almost, and this is from an outside perspective, but it feels almost unfair sometimes on the actors that feels like now part, and maybe has always been. And
it's always been.
Part and parcel with the job.
I know. Well, it's, you know, it's the old thing, you know, do you want to do it? You can always say, no, I don't want to do this.
And then you might lose not the, get part. The part.
Yeah, you do. You lose the part.
So,
but that's okay if you don't want to do it. So you can't keep saying, well, I'll do it and I hate it and I don't think it's right and I think it's wrong, but I'll do it because I want money. Get money another way.
Yeah,
which is why all actors should have a second string to their bow, you know. Serve in a pub, write, do something, play a violin, learn to be a plumber. Have something, because acting, what is it, something like 98% of all actors are out of work at any given time.
Yes.
Massive.
It's huge. Also, when you've had such a career as yours, another thing that people talk about often as actors is the fame element and finding that can be difficult or intrusive. When you had a career like yours, there must be moments where perhaps fame becomes overwhelming, or have you always just thought,
no, because I'm not that kind of famous, because I walk about in the streets and I take the tube and I shop in the supermarket and queue at the post office and things, and people know me, and also because of my travel shows, people know me as Joanna, so they talk to me as a friend. But when we did the New Avengers and I realised that people could recognise me, it was like having, sounds a bit dramatic, having your leg amputated. You go, I would rather have had my leg, but now I haven't. I'll have a false leg and I'll work with it. Once you realise your anonymity is gone forever, mm-hmm. deal with it how you can. And my way to deal with it was to make it something. So when people approached me, I would never be cross with them, because otherwise your life is destroyed. Mm. So if when somebody comes up, which they do now, can I have a selfie and things? And you go, yes, how lovely. A, it'll make their day happier because they get a nice selfie. B, you won't have been a total bitch. And it would have been fine. And you find it's okay. You find it's okay. So you have to learn to live with it. Learn to live with it how you will. Or you're haunted. If you're afraid people will recognize you, your days are shadowed with fear. So don't be afraid. Just, it's there. We're only well known because our faces are on the screen, which is where they're supposed to be.
Yes.
Like news readers who are also famous, people who tell you the weather, they're famous. Mm. I mean, famous means recognizable.
Yes. Also, without a phone, I guess maybe you're more switched off, or you're able to feel more of a distance to people tweeting or...
So I don't ever do that. No social media, nothing. Don't do any of that. There's no point in it. Look, if you want to live up to... If you want to react all the time... I write and I like paintings and drawings and reading fine work and stuff like that. It sounds sort of snooty, but what I don't want is to be shuffling through the gutter all the time. What's the point? Wake up in the morning and see if somebody said horrible things about you. No. If you haven't heard them, it doesn't hurt you.
So true.
So.
Right. Let's come on to talk about Conversations from a Long Marriage, which is beloved by our readers and listeners. Jan Etherington wrote me an email before this, and she kind of explained about writing this part for you. And I loved what she put, and I'm going to read it out. She said, she felt you epitomised a long married couple, still fizzing with love for music, wine and each other. Unlike, and these are Jan's words, the usual portrayal of older women in the media, in a coma or a care home, tetchy divorcees or ditzy nanas. What does this show teach us about age, about love, and about marriage?
It's really about marriage. It teaches us more about marriage. And a lot of people I've met say it's uncanny how she seems to have mirrored, that people have said, is she listening in on us?
Yes.
Has she got a microphone set in our floorboards or something? Because a lot of the small bickering or conversations they have or ideas they have, these are half-hour shows between two people only, which is me and Roger Allam. We're never named, but we're the married couple who've been married for a long time. They've had ups and downs in their marriage, but they live a fairly normal married life. They love each other. They've got friends who are sometimes enchanting, sometimes irritating. They live an ordinary kind of fairly humdrum existence. But her genius is actually finding out the sort of the sweet spots in marriage, which seem to exist in very, very many marriages. So a lot of people listen because it sounds so like their own lives.
And I found myself, I was lucky enough to have a preview for Series 5, and I found myself really giggling along as I was pottering around listening. And I feel that perhaps the beauty of it is also in these small moments, or the things that we find ourselves getting annoyed at with our partners, or the things that actually bring us back together, and our own neuroses almost, and how that other person just allows you to be you, realises you're going to react in said way, and loves you because of it.
I know.
And in spite of it sometimes.
And in another sort of addition to this is the fact that it's on radio, because people... They know, and they might even envisage me and Roger Allam, because we're both quite well-known faces. But actually, you're listening to these two and what their living room looks like, or when they wave goodbye to friends at the garden gate, or when they let the dog out, when they climb the stairs. You imagine, you make their house. Mm. When they're in a car driving somewhere, you're sort of in their car with them. And I think, you know, somebody once said radio is best because it has the best views. And you make them up in your head. You make up the scenery.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very valuable and stops people becoming bored. And I'm sure if it was us two on screen, this is Series 5, people might have thrown stones at us by now and said we've had enough. But you don't get bored with voices as swiftly as you do with faces.
Well, Series 5 for radio as well, it's really impressive.
It's lovely.
What do you think about the show, or what do you think it is about the show that makes people keep coming back?
there's something sweet about it. It's funny. It's lighthearted. It's got quite a few profound things. There's love and loss in it. There's loss in it. There's regret. There's a feeling of looking back. Both of them realize they're getting older, as a lot of our listeners on Radio 4 at that time of night, 6:30 in the evening, do. And I'm older than Roger, but although I feel young, by years, you know you're getting older. And that's where a lot of people are, because a lot of people at my age were children of the 60s, kind of baby boomers after the war. And we all know we're getting older, but we don't feel older in our heads. And these two don't feel older in their heads, mm-mm, but things go wrong. Somebody to step back or has to do this or take pills or, you know, these small human quandaries that they get into and somehow scramble out of. But behind it all is sweet love, which is very nice.
Yeah. How do you create that relationship with Roger?
Easy peasy. Masses of women come up to me and say, can I marry Roger Allam? No. A, he's married to Rebecca, but B, I'm first in line.
I mean, it always feels like when you listen that even in the moments where it is a bit tense, we were arguing, that in that studio, there is such a warmth and an energy, and I can imagine you all kind of smiling and having lots of fun, and it'd be quite joyous to
have. It's lovely because in the studio, which is not very much bigger than this studio we're sitting in, there are microphones where we are, and then behind the glass is everybody else. So it's only Roger and me there. They hear us, obviously, and we can have feedback and talk through. But we're such friends now. We've been doing this now. This is the fifth year. It's a year because we only do six little episodes a year. So this is 5 years. This is a long time. Yeah. We've been friends, and Jan's written for us with us in mind. And the same producer, Claire, and the same, we go to the same studios. Wilfredo is the same technician. So it's like a little tiny family who gathers once a year with these beautiful new scripts to do.
The radio editor, Radio Times, said that Roger apparently gasped at something in this script for series 5. Now, without giving too much away, can you tease potentially what that was?
No. If Roger gasped, I won't say a thing. No. I mean, I think I know. And it comes at a bit of a blindsider, sort of on episode 6 of this series.
Well, I think that's enough of a teaser. Yeah. Our listeners are going to be frantically trying to find out.
It comes out of the blue.
What do you think the future of the radio drama is?
I hope endless. I think the radio, the afternoon radio play, I love because they're so different. They're so wildly different. They always last 3/4 of an hour, you know, unless it's a series, in which case they alert you to it. But usually it's a completed play in 3/4 of an hour. And we all love having, at least I think most of us love having stories read to us. Or while you can do something, whether it's peeling potatoes or ironing or doing householdy chores, or whether you're sick in bed or whether you're, it's good to listen to something while you're doing something. So I think long live the radio play. And this is the only way you can get playwrights, is to have people who can write one-off plays. Because if you're trying to write for television, they almost always want a series. So we're in danger of losing Tom Stoppard and David Hares of the future. Christopher Hampton's, because they could write a single play and it would be put on as a television play or something. Mostly now, that's not done. And we've got to keep that alive, because if everything has to go to series, it's a bit level off. It's a bit too mundane, a bit too levelling off.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, what do you think, well, just to finish up, what would your tip be for a successful long marriage?
Adrian Edmondson had the answer to that. Don't get divorced. I think it's quite funny. I think respect your partner. Respect them. Don't marry them if you don't respect them. Mm. Don't expect to change people. Respect them for what they do and who they are. And treat them as the most important person in the world at all times. At all times. And be courteous. It's back to sort of very old human things. Don't take people for granted. Look out for them. There's a lot of pressure nowadays to look in on yourself and see how you're feeling and how whether I'm happy with that and what I do. And what I this is the certain way to unhappiness. Mm. It's the only sure way of getting unhappy immediately, is to think about yourself. So think out about other people. Think about your partner, and then think about the outside world. Have shared interests, I think. And if you can share their interest and get them to be interested in yours, that's lovely, because then occasionally we have another friend of mine said, we don't like sausages. And I loved that sort of we.
The royal we, but for themselves, I love it.
Yeah.
Well, Joanna Lumley, thank you
so much.
It's
been such a pleasure, Kellyanne, talking to you.
If you enjoyed this episode, you might like to listen to my conversation with Stephen Fry or my interview with the man behind Love Actually, Notting Hill and About Time, screenwriter Richard Curtis. Both can be found by scrolling back through the Radio Times podcast feed. Thank you for listening to the Radio Times podcast with me, your host, Kellyanne Taylor. Please do follow, rate and review wherever you get your podcast from. It helps other TV and film lovers find us. Until next Tuesday, happy viewing.